You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we take a look at a new kind of buy now, pay later financing, why it's happening, and some possible downsides. Now, how tall are you? A lot of people think a lot about their height. Many wish they could be taller. Pop culture and society tells us that taller is better, but our next guest says that notion is outdated if it ever was true in the first place. She wrote a column for the New York Times that says there has never been a better time to be short. Mara Altman is a writer and author. Her most recent book is called Gross Anatomy, Dispatches from the Front and Back. Mara, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this is an interesting topic for you. You're right, because you are on the short side of the spectrum yourself. Can you talk a little bit about your own height and how it's been a part of your life?
Yeah, so I'm 5 feet, and I've always been on the shorter side. I was so short, I guess, in, you know, elementary school, junior high, that my parents became concerned, and I ended up taking growth hormone to get a little bit taller.
And can you talk about why, and not just your parents, but a lot of people might think about height that way, like, oh no, we don't want our kid to turn out too short. There seems historically, I think it's no secret, to be a bias toward taller being better. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, definitely an assumption that it sucks to be short, you know. And I mean, I think back to when my parents, you know, took me to the endocrinologist, like things were pretty great in my life besides being short. I had friends. I wasn't complaining about it. It was the fear itself of like a short child that had them take me to the doctor. So, I mean, you know, I tried to look for the origin of this bias, and there's like a lot of possible reasons behind it. But there's that one evolutionary reason is that we were kind of like, we evolved to think that tall was better because, you know, a taller person could protect their family, be more likely to hunt and get food for their family. So to this day, we continue to think that tall is better.
And the
but when you look at, yeah.
Sorry, yeah, the bulk of your essay suggests that, well, in 2023, those rules may no longer apply. Why not?
Because we don't have to go hunt for food anymore. You know, the people bring home the food are the people sitting in the chair. And so like my 5'6" husband, you know, I joke that maybe we'll evolve to like appreciate a partner who can sit in a chair for 8 hours without getting up to pee or evolve out of the need to blink, you know, as you're looking at your computer screen. But so far we have not caught up with that in our brains because it takes millions of years.
Do you still see, I'm guessing, some of that built-in bias, whether jokingly or not, where people, you know, have expressed that preference for tall over short?
All the time. It's in our language. It's, you know, you even see it when someone will take like a picture and then they'll look at the camera and they'll be like at the photo and they'll be like, oh my God, I look so tall in this one. You know, they're excited about it. It's in our language, like statuesque. A tall drink of water. It's, you know, what people set their dating minimums to online. You know, there was this person that wrote in a letter to the editor, and she said that like her sons are short. And one time one of the kids in class came up to her and said, I'm the tallest in class. And she said, you know what? There's nothing wrong with that. And that just shows that, like, you know, it was a tweak in language, and it's like something that you don't usually hear. Usually that's like something that you would congratulate someone for.
You mentioned that your husband is also on the shorter side of average, and you touch on this in your piece. There's this, people call it, I think, Napoleon syndrome or something, the attribution of sort of an angry chip on the shoulder personality,
right,
toward shorter men in particular. You say in your own family and in research, that's not really how it is.
Yeah, I mean, it's more that, you know, there is a compensation for it, and it can show up in many ways. But another way it can show up is like in a pro-social way, in a way that benefits them. That's like developing humor or being really kind. You know, it's another way to get the attention that you're not getting because you don't automatically get it because you're tall or have that social preference.
Height discrimination has always seemed weird to me because it's like, literally one aspect of ourselves that we had pretty much no control over, right? Like we have no, there are very few life choices that will make us taller or shorter.
Very true. Yeah.
So what do you say to people, other people in your own situation who are, you know, shorter than average, who may feel bad about it, who may have, I guess, internalized that attitude towards shortness?
I mean, writing this essay was a big thing that I was trying to do to show that there are really good things about being short. And I think that's like a step towards fighting the bias a bit. I mean, I thought it was interesting that I got a lot of hate mail from tall people. Like I felt like they would be very secure in their situation of being preferred. And I think that they felt like their privilege was a little bit, at risk of weakening.
And in your piece, you lay out some just like modern day practical advantages of being shorter. What are some of the things you see in your own life?
Practical is that you have, shorter people live longer, have less incidence of cancer. You know, you can get your way through a crowd pretty easy. You have more space on an airplane. The only thing I could think of that I can't do that tall people can is like reach really high things. And you can get a ladder from that. And tall people are pretty kind, usually at the grocery store. You know, they want to help out. Feel like those limbs are worth something these days that they can't go hunting and stuff.
As we wrap up, Mara, are you just generally hopeful that we can stop judging each other based on height?
I am hopeful. I think it'll be a slow process, but I think what like the interest in this article and the subject matter means that it's something that people have really been thinking about. You know, it hits home somehow. It struck a chord.
Mara, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Mara Altman is a writer and author. She wrote a column for the New York Times called There's Never Been a Better Time to Be Short. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a Cuban refugee who lives in Madison. He's also one of the people featured in the new podcast, WPR Reports Uprooted. As a warning, this story contains brief mentions of violence.
Osvaldo Durruti was sitting in a Wisconsin prison in the mid-1990s. He was in his 30s, and he was desperate to get out. He wanted to go home to Cuba, so he concocted a plan.
I had a sad moment.
And this sad moment led to something quite disturbing. In his mind, to get out of prison, Durruti was going to have to kill the most hated man behind bars.
I went little violent, you know, toward, you know, inmates, you know, Jeffrey Dahmer, you know.
Durruti thought he'd get out if he killed Wisconsin's most notorious serial killer, Jeffrey Dahmer. And it almost happened in the prison chapel. But the weapon broke and guards intervened.
But I'm not proud of that. At that moment, you know, my mind was so disturbed. Because when I tried to kill him, the reason I did it because I want to go back to Cuba. I don't want to be here in this country no more. I want to go back to Cuba.
But the assault never got Durruti deported like he hoped. So how did he get here? Durruti settled in Madison, Wisconsin after coming to the United States as part of the Mariel boatlift, a moment in 1980 when 125,000 Cuban exiles were allowed to leave the island. Of that group, almost 15,000 were sent to Fort McCoy in Sparta, Wisconsin, including Durruti. At Fort McCoy, he made friends with a group of musicians who ended up playing for people across the state.
We all got together. We started, you know, playing music. And that was when I ended up going to different places. And that was my way out of the environment, the McCoy, you know.
Once Durruti was out on his own, he settled in Madison. He liked the people, the city, the nightlife. But discrimination and a language barrier made finding a job difficult. So he turned to the drug trade to make easy money. Durruti says he wasn't thinking about the consequences.
We were selling dopes, mm-hmm. You know, we were stealing. We were doing the crazy thing, you know. I can never say regret because, you know, once I do something, I don't look back. If I pay for my mistake, I pay. If I do wrong.
He paid for that mistake with a prison sentence, where he would later cross paths with a notorious serial killer. The sentence is also getting in the way of him going back to Cuba. He wants to return to see his family, like his sister, who he hasn't seen in person in more than 40 years.
The first thing I want to do, I want to embrace her and, you know, just raise her up, you know, and hug. Give her the hug that, you know, nobody ever she never get the hug from her, you know. She say, what you gonna do is cook for me.
But he can't go back. Even though he's no longer in prison, Durruti has felony convictions, so he can't return to Cuba or become a U.S. citizen.
When I came here, I was wild, and nothing good was on my mind. Now, you know, it's like, you know, I got better understanding what it's like to be an American citizen. And not only that, but putting me behind bars, it was something that I needed because I learned how to become a man.
And now, Durruti just wants a second chance.
We pay for our mistake, you know. We are not a threat to society anymore. We just want, you know, to ask for forgiveness, consideration, opportunity to, you know, grow as a man, as a father. You know, we're not perfect. We just want, you know, be part of American dream, you know.
To learn more about Osvaldo Durruti's life in Cuba and Wisconsin, check out the podcast WPR Reports Uprooted. All 8 episodes plus historical photos, all at WPR.org/uprooted. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell & Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, if you're given the chance to pay in small interest-free installments for that cashmere sweater or whatever you've been looking at, should you take it? An economist breaks down the risks of using these new buy now, pay later financing apps when buying stuff online. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. If you've bought anything online lately, you might have seen the option at checkout to break your purchase down into a few interest-free payments. This lending method is called buy now, pay later. Gotten big in the last few years. The value of buy now, pay later loans from companies like Affirm, Afterpay, and Klarna increased over 1,000% from 2019 to 2021. The idea is you can buy just about anything with buy now, pay later, even something as cheap as a burger from Uber Eats. These buy now, pay later loans sell themselves as 0% interest with minimal penalties for a missed payment. Is all too good to be true, though? Marco DiMaggio is an Ogunlesay Associate Professor of Business Administration. I'm sorry, Ogunlesay Family Associate Professor of Business Administration at Harvard Business School, who's researched these buy now, pay later plans. Marco, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
There's a generational divide, I think, here. This whole thing's going to be under the radar for a lot of people, including, I'll admit, me. Explain what these things are and how they work.
Sure. So after, during and after COVID, this has become very popular. This is just a different way of making a transaction, mostly online. So rather than imagining buying a shirt, you add it to the shopping cart. And once you are at the checkout, you have different options. You can pay with a credit card, you can pay with PayPal. Nowadays, you can pay in 4 or in multiple installments. And this is a buy now and pay later option. And this is offered by some of the companies you mentioned before, Klarna, Afterpay, and so on and so forth. And this allowed people to basically pay whatever they are buying in multiple installments. Usually, you pay in 4 with 0 interest rate, meaning you put a down payment today, which is 1/4 for your purchase. So if you are buying a shirt for $100, you are paying right now $25. And then 2 weeks from now, they are going to withdraw from your account another $25, and then 2 weeks after, and then 2 weeks after. And finally, after 4 payment, you are done paying for that shirt.
Now, it's different than layaway, right? Because I get the shirt right away. Do I have that right?
Correct.
Okay.
Exactly.
And it's different from credit cards. Why would people use this option instead of, say, or why are people using this option instead of, say, charging it on a credit card?
Yes. So I think that the biggest appeal is because they advertise that this is a zero interest rate option. And this has been particularly appealing for younger folks, probably those that have a tendency to not like credit cards because maybe they've seen their parents get in trouble with using credit cards. And so the idea is that you are going to get exactly the same thing. You are going to get instant liquidity, meaning you get these funds right now. The merchant is happy. You get the good that you are purchasing, and then you have you are committing yourself to repay this loan, because it is a loan, in the next 4 installment. And so that's I think the biggest appeal, the advertising that there is a zero interest rate, and also the fact that it's very easy to get, in the sense that the underwriting of the borrower, so when you quote unquote apply online, that's very easy. It's everything is online and it's instantaneous. And but there is basically no pulling of your credit report, so there is no effect on your FICO score. But people should know that most of these companies do report their information to credit bureau, especially the negative information. Mm-hmm. So if you do default on a buy now pay later product, your FICO score will be affected as if you were defaulting on your credit card.
Now, if I'm a company doing this, I'm fronting you the money for your shirt at 0% interest. How am I making money off of this deal?
So it's the merchant that is paying. So the merchant is paying between 6% and 8% of the purchase of the transaction to the company that is offering this service. And so think about this: the merchant is usually paying about 2% or a little bit more than that for a credit card. Right. So every time I use my Amex, the merchant unfortunately is going to pay a transaction fee that is going to go to Amex. Now they are paying a significantly higher transaction fee that is going to go to Klarna and Afterpay. Why are they doing that? Well, they're doing that because these individuals that are using these products are going to buy more than what they would have bought otherwise.
Talking to Marco DiMaggio from the Harvard Business School about the rise of these buy now, pay later apps, programs, credit things. Big now, but some risks, Marco. You wrote in a recent piece in The Atlantic, it might look pretty good for now. What are the downsides you're seeing?
Yes, so we are seeing that a significant fraction of these individuals end up in trouble by using these products. The reason is because there is an automatic withdrawal of your funds from your account, and we observe that these individuals tend to use too much of these loan products, of these buy now and pay later. And what ends up happening is that they end up paying either late fees or overdraft fees. And so this would suggest that these individuals sort of overextended themselves by using these additional products. And so ex ante was a great idea. You know, it seems like free money because they don't charge you an interest rate. But there are some people that tend to overuse this and overextend themselves. And so that's pretty problematic, especially because it's not regulated as a loan by any of the agencies. And so it also has less of a regulatory oversight.
I wanted to ask about this. This isn't, I guess, technically a bank. It's not technically a credit card. So is there any kind of regulation of these things?
So I think the only agency that is really looking into this and has started, because exactly there have been some complaints, is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. But technically, because there is no interest rate that has been charged, these are not loans. And in fact, you know, a bank might not be very happy about this, because they don't have visibility into this type of loans. So think about if Marco goes and starts buying furniture using Buy Now and Pay Later, he might end up in a lot of debt. The issue is that nobody else is going to recognize that Marco indeed is already into debt, because they don't report to the credit bureaus. And so the other lenders are not going to have any visibility into this. And so this is even more problematic, because then now I can create a hidden risk in the market where neither the regulator nor the other creditors have any visibility into.
Let's talk to, you know, a younger consumer, someone in their low 20s, say, and they're saying, you know, I want to buy stuff online, at least from time to time. Marco, what do you recommend they do, or at least think about before making a decision of credit card versus buy now, pay later versus whatever other option?
So I think the aspect that I like about the buy now and pay later is that there is some sort of self-commitment, right? If I know that if I use the credit card, I'm not sure whether I'm going to really repay it at the end of the month, so before being charged for interest rate, then it makes sense to use a buy now and pay later, because I will love to do that no matter what, except in the case in which I don't have any money. So that aspect of the commitment and to avoid interest rate, I like it. The issue is that people might keep lose track of all the buy now and pay later transaction they have. And so what I suggest is that there needs to be much more attention about how many of these transactions you are making, and only make the ones where you know to have the funds for. So don't buy the shirt hoping only with the $25, and that's the only thing that you have in your account. Do it if you already know that you are gonna have the full amount, and keep track of that. That's the only way in which you can avoid the overdraft, you can avoid insufficient funds, you can avoid them reporting negative information to credit bureaus.
In our last half a minute or so, Marco, do you think these buy now, pay later things are gonna get bigger, or are they gonna hit a wall at some point?
I think they have been very successful for the for two main factors. One was COVID, so people at home browsing and trying to sort of spend as much as possible, the additional liquidity they got from the government. And the second one is a booming market. Now, with both of these conditions not being true anymore, I think those are becoming more and more of a risky product, both for the consumer as well as for the creditors. We've seen more and more defaults on this.
Marco, we'll leave it there. Thanks for sharing this with us.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
That's Marco DiMaggio, the Ogun Lacy Family Associate Professor of Business Administration at Harvard Business School. He talked to us today about the explosion of these buy now, pay later financing apps in online retail. Have you encountered this? Do you use it? Love to hear from you. Email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the Biden administration is making the case for more legal protections for renters. Find out what that could look like and some of the challenges facing people who rent their housing these days. And a Senate committee is digging into the business practices of Ticketmaster, the event ticket and booking giant, after a Taylor Swift fiasco and decades of criticism of their business model. Check out the history behind that story and what could come next. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we look at competing priorities for expanding public education funding and expanding school choice in Wisconsin, after Governor Evers outlined his education goals in his State of the State address last night. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the U.S. and Germany have both agreed to supply the Ukrainian military with top-of-the-line tanks after weeks of wrangling. We'll check out the decision and what it could mean. First, in his State of the State address last night, Governor Tony Evers highlighted his priorities for education funding here in Wisconsin.
Doing what's best for our kids has always been what's best for our state, and today we can afford to do more. So I'm going to deliver on the promise I made before the election to use a portion of our state's historic surplus to make an historic investment in our kids and in our schools.
As we get rolling in the state's budget season, Evers announced he would seek additional money for expanded mental health services for students, a boost in reading education, and in general, a substantial boost in state funding for local districts. Republican lawmakers have signaled and repeated last night that they'd like to see an expansion of school choice and voucher programs in the state, possibly even some version of universal school choice. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What did you think of what the governor and what the Republican response from Robin Voss had to say about education funding in the state? Do you want more money going to public schools? Are there particular areas of need that you see if you work in a local district? What do you see as your main budget challenges? Then ideas for expanding school choice, expanding school vouchers. Should everyone in the state have the same access to the vouchers, or should there be income limits as there are now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Marguerite Pienaar-Parks is Professor of Leadership, Literacy, and Social Foundations at the UW Oshkosh College of Education and Human Services. Marguerite, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon, and thank you very much for having me.
All right, with an asterisk at everything we're about to talk about, we don't have a lot of specific budget details from the governor or from Republicans. They're talking in broad strokes so far. All that said, let's start with public schools. What do you see as areas in public schools that could maybe use a boost in funding?
Well, when I looked at what Governor Evers was talking about yesterday, I think one of the ones that he talked about is retaining our teachers. It's critical that our teachers be paid a fair wage, that they want to stay. And it's not just important for the teachers. It's also important for the students, because when they see the same teachers in the building year after year, that also gives them a feeling of stability in the school building. So I think that one of the things he said he was going to fund, retaining teachers, is a really critical funding.
Looking at some of the other areas he brought up, we heard mental health funding would be a priority, $500 million overall for mental health and behavioral services. Are you seeing a need for that in our schools?
We've always seen a need for that. And we started doing cuts. We start cutting some of the things that students need the most to help with their mental health. One of the things we know is there are not nearly enough counselors or social workers in the buildings with which to support the students. Mental health challenges are going through the roof in all age groups. I was just listening today about how the number of people who are calling the suicide line in Wisconsin has almost doubled with the new numbers. So it's the parents who need mental health, it's the students who need mental health, it's the educators. I mean, in today's society, it is going up. So yes, we definitely need more support, more educators who are well-educated in issues of social-emotional learning, are well-educated in trauma-informed care, so that they are making any decisions they make based on knowledge versus based on intuition.
And then $20 million for improving reading skills. I know there have been concerns with our standardized tests when it comes to reading before COVID, definitely since COVID started, and the concerns about the impact of remote learning. Are there strategies you'd like to see tackled to try to at least catch up with some of the reading skills we might have lost?
For those of you who've never taught reading, and I'm a high school teacher, by the way, but I spent 5 semesters team teaching with one of the best reading specialists in the state, Dr. Michael Ford, and discovered how incredibly difficult teaching reading is, because every student has a different issue. Is it the blends? Is it the phonemes? You know, is it the consonant blends, the vowel blends? And teachers don't have the time, time's a big one, to sit down and individually be able to assess each child to the level that would really be helpful. So yes, any help that can be given to teachers with which, so that they can once again individualize the reading needs of students, especially in younger levels, is critical. We also know that we tend to lose our readers from 2nd to 3rd grade because of the transition from picture books to chapter books. And we also know that we tend to lose our readers really when they go into middle school. So it's really critical that we take a look not just at the early development ages, but at other times when we're losing our readers.
We're talking to Marguerite Pinnock-Parks from UW Oshkosh's College of Education and Human Services, looking at budget priorities from Governor Evers in his State of the State address last night, the Republican response from Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. I want to give a listen to Speaker Voss now talking about school choice. Republicans in the legislature hoping to see some sort of expansion instead of, or maybe in addition to, increases in public school funding. Here's a listen to some of what Speaker Voss had to say.
While my Democratic colleagues want to make the issue about public versus private schools, school choice isn't just about kids leaving a public school to go to a private one. In fact, in the 2021-22 school year, 71,489 kids open enrolled, leaving one public school to choose a different public school. You see, it's all about parents picking the best school for their children, not being trapped in the one where they happen to live, whether or not it's the right fit for their son or daughter.
Marguerite, before we get into pros and cons of school choice, can you talk about the variety within school choice? When we say that phrase, it can cover a lot of ground, from a public charter to public, going to the public school, a town over, to private schools, to voucher schools. There's a lot contained in that phrase, right?
Yes, there is. I was writing it down and listening. And I think that is one of the biggest misunderstandings when we talk about school choice, because it can be you choose to enroll your child in the school in the district next door because of their athletic program, because of their music program, because of their reading scores. That's one type. Charter schools are public schools. They tend to have to follow all of the public rules, with the exception of ones that they've written in to their governance policy. But for the most part, you know, they're public teachers with public school licenses. And then private schools, of course, run on a whole different list. And that's really where the vouchers come in, is the idea that, and it is a lot about, Representative Voss was wrong when he says it's not just about one kid going to another, because it's also incredibly important about the funding that you take away from one school to give to another school. And that's where one of the critical issues of going from public to private is as Dr. Evers said, Governor Evers, I know him as Dr. Evers, as Governor Evers said, when you put money into, we need to put money into our public schools, not take it away. And vouchers take it away from the students who are still at that school there.
And one idea, Assembly Speaker Voss, one of the biggest proponents of doing something along the lines of a universal school choice. Again, that can cover a lot of ground in different details. But one basic idea is saying, okay, we have currently an income limit in the state's voucher programs, plural, Milwaukee, Racine, and then the statewide one. The idea of saying, okay, no more income limit. Any parent can take advantage of that voucher program, use it at a private, religious, whatever school in their community. What are your thoughts on the specific idea of changing, removing that income limit on the use of vouchers?
Throughout my history as an education professor and as an educator who worked in what you would call an urban school, I'm always looking at issues of equity. And what happens with the voucher program, which some people say is about equality, not equity, is this idea that there are people, parents, who will put their children into voucher schools even though they could pay the tuition, which once again would take a space away from a child who can't. But then you also have to look at who knows how to navigate the voucher program, who has the education, the skills, the knowledge, the friends, the educators, who can tell them how to navigate it, because it's not that simple to just say, I want to put my child into the school. And there are a lot of things you have to know. There's lots of hoops you have to jump through. There's lots of paperwork you have to do. And that takes the equity out of it, because that means the people who are able to navigate the system are going to be ones whose kids get in. And that's not equitable.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Lauren joins us now in Janesville. Lauren, hi.
Hi. I'm a mental health counselor. I handle adults primarily. And I work for a federally qualified clinic in Beloit. The family issues that I deal with, I know, are trickling down to our kids. Our kids are in a world of hurt. They need mental health care. They need social workers there to help them and families, navigate systems, et cetera. The more investment that we do in their mental health while they are still growing and developing, will turn them into adults that are, I'm trying to think of the word here, but they will be secure within themselves. They will be mentally stable, et cetera, that are able to handle jobs and pressures of life, et cetera. What I would like to see happen with part of that money, not just straight funding to go to clinics, et cetera, but there is such a shortage. Nobody wants to go into this profession. And there aren't enough therapists, even the ones that just graduate, there are not enough social workers and graduates to go around. We really need to partner with the schools. We really need to make a push for some sort of incentive for folks that have the ability to do this type of work.
Lauren, thanks a lot for the call. What do you think, Marguerite?
Oh, I completely agree with her. One of the things that I've always said, you know, that if I could create my ideal teacher education program, because that's what I teach in, every person who's going to be a teacher would have to take a course in counseling. And that currently is not a requirement, but teachers spend an enormous amount of time counseling students who are having mental health issues or, you know, have just had a bad day. I had a parent when I was teaching high school who found his son skipping school. So he literally threw the kid into my classroom. I mean, literally back of the neck, feet. And how is that kid supposed to be able to learn when that happens? And as a first year teacher, which I was not prepared to help him. Every teacher needs a course in counseling because, as Sarah said, there's just not enough. I'm sorry, as the caller said, there's just certainly is not enough.
Thanks again for that call. We're talking to Marguerite Pienick-Parks, Professor of Leadership, Literacy, and Social Foundations at the UW Oshkosh College of Education and Human Services, talking about state funding for public education and for school choice programs. Governor Evers highlighted his proposals for a boost in public school funding last night in a State of the State speech. Republican lawmakers say they want to expand the school choice system in various ways in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with the state's current budget surplus. When it comes to education, where would you want money to go? Public schools, if so, are there particular things you think we need to do? School choice programs, expand, contract, stay where we are, take off income limits on the voucher program? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about school funding and school choice with UW Oshkosh Education Professor Marguerite Pienick-Parks. You can join in with your thoughts, what you want to see happen in this year's state budget, this two-year state budget, when it comes to funding of public schools, various kinds of choice programs in the state. Call 800-642-1234. Go back to your calls now. Sarah is with us in Madison. Sarah, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Sarah?
I'm a retired public school teacher and feel very strongly that funding should go to our public schools. It's the great equalizer. Everybody can get a wonderful education. And I just wonder when the last time any of our Republican legislators have ever been in a public school. Of all the governors that we've had, Evers would be the most knowledgeable about public schools, having been a public school superintendent and an educator. These vouchers only privatize, really, public education. And I know about charter schools, and they're publicly funded, but they do not operate on the same scale as what we call regular public schools. I feel very strongly about Republicans destroying public education in our state and in our country.
Sarah, thanks for the call. Marguerite, there's a concern from Republicans, and not just Republicans, that some public schools aren't doing the job as well as they could be, and something needs to change. What do you think?
One of the things that I talk to my students about, and this would be a class as people preparing to be principals, is that one of the issues with American public schools historically, and you can go back through history, is that every time we change parties in power, we change the ideology of education. And that's because the different parties have different ideologies. I always tell my students, it's not that one is better than the other, it's just that they both have different ideas on how to make our educational program the best we can. But the problem is that we never stay on one track long enough to get something accomplished. So we will implement No Child Left Behind, and 8 years later we do something else. And then we'll implement like all the stuff that came out of Nation at Risk, and then we do something else. When you look at the education of Finland, which, by the way, has no standardized test, and their teachers are one of the highest paid professions and one of the highest trained professions, they set a goal years ago of what they wanted their schools to look like, and they kept on the same track. I really think that's important, because as long as we continue to change from ideology to ideology, then how can we get? Education needs to be in the middle, but we can't get in the middle because we continuously swing to extremes one way or the other. So to answer the question, it's we need to find a way to that old adage of, instead of seeing why we have all the fish in the pond, why don't we go up to the front of the river to see who's drawing them in or what's drawing them in? Why aren't we going to see that as opposed to trying to just, oh, let's do this, oh, let's do that, oh, let's do this, oh, let's do that, without really looking at what the educational needs are?
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Louise now in Dodgeville. Louise, hello.
Hi. I live in Southwest Wisconsin and am able to listen to Iowa Public Radio along with Wisconsin Public Radio. But I was very shocked, and not shocked, that Governor Kim Reynolds, who's a Republican, and Iowa has a Republican House and Senate, they just passed a big bill to privatize basically education. So I'm wondering, one state over, what the impact is going to be on Wisconsin. Has Iowa passed all this?
Louise, thanks for the call. I don't know if it's passed completely. I know Iowa is advancing something comparable to that universal school choice, a scholarship available to anyone using private schools, as I vaguely understand it. Marguerite, are you watching Iowa or other states?
I wish I was. I'm from Iowa. Actually, my PhD is from the University of Iowa, and I went to school there. Once again, when you start... I'm going to go back to the caller a minute ago, Sarah from Madison. When you try to privatize schools, that means you don't know what goes on in schools. I would love to see any of these people who are trying to prioritize schools to go into a public school and teach for a week, do all the prep and all of that. Education was not meant to be privatized. The very first law that required education in this country, the old Luther Satan law in Massachusetts, was established so that everybody in that community could get a fair and equal education so that they could become members of the United States and voting and educated members. To privatize takes away what our whole entire educational system in the United States has always been based on.
Louise, thanks for that call. And Louise is quite right. The governor of Iowa signed that into law just yesterday, it looks like. In just our last minute or so, Marguerite, what are you watching for as the budget negotiations go forward here?
I'm looking to see that Governor Evers is able to do what he wants to do for education. Also the bridges and the roads and all of that. But with education, we've got so many phenomenal teachers out there and administrators and superintendents and so many students who so deserve everything we can give them. And that's not just money, but the money creates opportunities. And we don't want to take those opportunities away from any of our students, but especially the students who are the most in need. So I'm looking forward to Governor Evers and his budget and the legislature creating most opportunities to create equitable access for all of our students in the state of Wisconsin so that we continue to be a great state.
Marguerite, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Marguerite Bienick-Parks is a professor of leadership, literacy, and social foundations at the UW Oshkosh School of Education and Human Services. We talked to her today about Governor Evers' proposals for increasing public school funding and Republican state lawmakers' goals to expand the school choice system here in Wisconsin. You can keep sharing your thoughts over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, we'll get the latest updates from the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the announcement that the U.S. and Germany will send tanks to the Ukrainian military. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.